Go to Hebrews chapter 10. And before we start to study, I have to make a little confession. If tonight is a little shabby, I'll tell you what happened. I work with my notes all week and then don't print them until sometimes the very day, like I came down tonight about 6 to print the notes. And yesterday afternoon, the disk on the computer was doing something that was my fault, but you know how you can get mad at an inanimate thing, and it feels so good to kick your car or something that hasn't run quite right, and you just feels good to bang it. And so I grabbed the disc and did what I wanted to do for so long. I just took it like that and twisted it, and threw it out, and I thought it was a different one. And this is my notes for tonight. So I came down to print. I don't know, Alice. Can you iron these out? This is probably dead. So I pulled together in the last half hour all that I could get in my mind. So if I'm shabby, it's because I'm shabby. Okay, Hebrews 10. And if you want the full lesson, someone can have this. Also, we regularly get paper supplies from Arby's downtown, which is considerably cheaper, I think, than anyone else. And some have mentioned they have a hard time finding this kind of three-hole notebook stuff. This is $2.50 for 100 sheets. And you've got, how many do you have, Jay? Five? Four? Okay. If you'd like for us to go ahead and just supply this and you know, let her know, and we'll keep a stock up. Okay, Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10 is made up of three paragraphs. And the three paragraphs revolve about the sacrifice of Christ, and by way of overview, they look like this. They first of all make a presentation of the perfect sacrifice, and that is done in chapter 10, verses 1 through 18. And the way that presentation will run will be he'll go back to the Old Testament and talk about the deficiency of the priests under the law, and that will be in verses 1 through 4. Reading in verse 1, "For the law, since it has only a shadow of good things to come," and he'll begin to give the weak points and the deficiencies that were there. As soon as he does that, he then turns to the efficiency of Christ. And that is in chapter 10, verses 5 through 10. And we'll have one of the strongest sections anywhere in the book of Hebrews on the perfection of the work of Jesus Christ, especially in terms of his attitude toward obeying the Father's will, a classic passage on that, which we will get to tonight. Then the third paragraph begins with verse 19. Verse 19 says, "Since, therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus," then you have exhortations beginning in verse 22. "Let us draw near." Verse 23, "Let us hold fast." Verse 24, "Let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds." So the emphasis there will be upon the appropriation of his sacrifice. And that goes from chapter 10, verse 19, down through verse 25. Emphasis on appropriating what he has done for us. Then finally, when you come to the last paragraph, which begins with verse 26, which says, "If we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there remains no longer a sacrifice for sin." And this is a section of very, very strong warning about our relationship to his sacrifice. 26 down through the final verse, which is chapter 10 and verse 39. So those are the things we'll be working with in this study and the next time we get to Hebrews and so forth. Now, one other thing by way of introduction that we ought to note is that in chapter 10, we have the seedbed for what the rest of the book is going to be about. And that revolves three things. First of all, in 10:22, we read, "Let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith." And that is going to be a seedbed for what is going to be developed later in the rest of the book. Then in verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope. And the word hope is going to plant the seed that will be developed later. And then finally, in verse 24, let us consider how to stimulate one another to love. And so notice you have the little Pauline trio here of love, faith, and hope. And the way these will be developed will be the concept of faith will be expanded in chapter 11. You well know that's the faith chapter. The concept of hope gets developed in chapter 12. Chapter 12 is the part that he says, we have something great as believers. Don't let the feeble hands of discouragement defeat you. And he emphasizes hope. Then finally, when you come to chapter 12, it begins by saying in verse 1, let love of the brethren continue. And therefore you have a development of the theme of love throughout that chapter. So in chapter 10, in three short verses, we get what is going to be the seedbed of the study in the following chapters. All right, now let's go to presentation of the perfect sacrifice, Hebrews 10, 1 through 18. It's going to set him in front of us in these verses. And we start out with the listing, one by one, of the deficiencies of the Old Testament sacrifice, what it could not do. And we'll have several of them. Number one is found in verse 1, which reads, for the law, since it has only a shadow of good things to come. Number one, it is deficiency because, and each one of these points now will give why it was deficient. It is deficient because it was shadow, not substance. It's his first deficiency. It was shadow, it was not substance. And the emphasis will be Christ is just the opposite. He is not shadow. He is substance. And we've got that expressed in the first verse that says the law, since it has only a shadow of good things. And therefore we have a little expression, shadow, Greek word skia. And the word for shadow is a word that is used by an outline cast by an object. It's an outline cast by an object of some kind. We can illustrate it very easily by just taking this pen and laying it here on the overhead projector. There it is. There's a skia. Now, what does it lack? It gives you something. You see it lying there, and you have a good idea that that's a pen. And the two characteristics that are there are lack of detail, and second, lack of function. In other words, you see this here, and you do not see the detail of the clip, you do not see the brand name written on it, you lack detail, but you do understand something about it. You get enough detail to know it's a pen, but you don't get enough detail to really know a lot of the finer points about it. At the same time, try to pick up the shadow and write with it. And the shadow will do nothing in terms of functioning. It will not function as a pen. That's the Old Testament sacrifice. It was a shadow, and you could see that there's death, there's a shedding of blood. You could see all of that there, and yet you couldn't see the details of it. You could see the lamb dying, but the lamb could not function to save you. And that's exactly the first comparison that he's making in Hebrews chapter 10. All right, the second deficiency that is there. For the law, since it has only a shadow of good things to come, and not the very form of these things, can never by the same sacrifices year by year, which they offer continually, make perfect those who draw near. And the second deficiency is they were deficient because they were powerless. They were shadow, not substance, and because they were second, powerless. The powerlessness is expressed in the idea that they could not bring to perfection. And as we've said previously, the word perfection is a word that means to bring anything to its intended goal. To bring to an intended goal. And of course, what was the goal of the priesthood? We've had it before. Remember, the goal of the priesthood had three things in mind that it had to do between God and man. Number one, it had to remove sin barrier. It had to link man to God. And finally, it had to make that permanent or make it eternal. And so any priest functioning in the Old Testament, under the Old Testament priesthood, had all of these things that were the intentions of a priest. You've got God over here, man over here, you've got the barrier between, you've got to deal with that. You've got to take this man and link him up to God, doctrine of reconciliation, and then you've got to take that union and make it eternal so he will have an eternal salvation. And he's simply saying, the offering of an animal could never do that. It was powerless in sense of bringing a thing to its goal. So verse 2, or 1, for since it has only a shadow of good things to come and not the very form of things, can never by the same sacrifices year by year which they continually make, make perfect those who draw near. Now, what is the main proof that Hebrews will give us that shows that these sacrifices are powerless? Well, the main argument for the fact that they're powerless is the fact that they had to be repeated. And that is a third deficiency in the Old Testament. And that deficiency is because they were repeated, not final. They were repeated, not final. And notice that is the theme idea in verse 2. Verse 2 simply reads, otherwise they would not have ceased to be offered, because the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would no longer have a consciousness of sins. And so the idea is the deficiency lies in the fact that they were not final. Actually, the procedure, and we ought to put this out, the actual procedure in the Old Testament was something like this. And it's again, keep in mind that the Day of Atonement is what is in view in these verses. The actual procedure was to allow sin to accumulate for 1 year. And then at the end of the accumulation of 1 year, then you would have the Day of Atonement. And, of course, every single year it would be the same thing. Figuratively, you would empty the bucket and then drip, 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 drip all year long until the bucket got full again. And then symbolically, they would dump the bucket, Day of Atonement, and then they would start all over again. And his emphasis, therefore, is that that is very deficient. They don't really get the job done. And the proof is that they are not final because of their continual repetition. All right, fourth deficiency is they brought remembrance of sin, not forgiveness. They brought remembrance, not forgiveness. This is verse 3. Remembrance of sin, not forgiveness of sin. Verse 3. It says, in those sacrifices there was a reminder of sin year by year. In other words, the Day of Atonement was the annual reminder that no sacrifice for sin has been adequate yet. Because as you participated in the Day of Atonement, you always were remembering, be sure to mark your calendar and be back this time next year because we're going to have to do it over again. And when you met the next year, you always were reminded that, well, we're going to have to do this again. And the fact that sin had accumulated every year was, they were reminded of by means of this sacrifice. All right? Now, notice in these verses 3 and 4. All right, from that now, we move to the efficiency of Christ's work. 5 through 10. And we start out with the origin of a perfect sacrifice. And the origin of the perfect sacrifice is the mind of God the Father. Now notice how you've got that and how the emphasis is that the working out of salvation is a result of Christ responding to the will of his Father. For example, reading down in chapter 10 and verse 7. Christ speaking, "Then I said, Behold, I have come in the roll of the book, it is written of me, to do thy will, O God." So 10:7 refers to thy will. This is taking salvation all the way back to its roots, all the way back to the fact that salvation originated in the mind of God. And then you have the same thing if you come down to verse 9. "Then he said, Behold, I have come to do thy will." So the same thing repeated again in 10:9. And then you have a thought in 10:10. It says, "By this will we have been sanctified." So notice the triple repetition here of the will of God. And what is he doing? He's taking salvation right back to its origin. And he's simply saying the salvation that I, the person of Christ, brought about was actually a thing that originated in the mind and the plan of God. And so you take it all the way back to its ultimate origin with God the Father. Notice also in 10:5b, reading the entire verse, "Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, Sacrifice and offering thou hast not desired, but a body thou hast prepared for me." So notice it's all emphasis on what God the Father has done in terms of salvation. Second, you have the executor of salvation, who is Jesus Christ. And that is also in the same phrase, such as in verse 7, "He came to do thy will." And the expression "to do" indicates that everything he did was simply a reflection and a match perfectly of the will of God. Then finally, you have a remark about the effectiveness. And the effectiveness comes down to chapter 10 and verse 10. "By this will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Christ once for all." The word sanctified, set apart, is perfect tense. And it's looking at the completed, perfect work of salvation that is brought about by Christ. All right, now what is, number 4, the passage that points to his sacrifice? The passage pointing to the sacrifice of Christ is now quoted beginning in verse 5. It says, Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, quote, in Christ, "Sacrifice and offering thou hast not desired, but a body thou hast prepared for me." Notice in the 10th verse, we start with the incarnation. That's where we are time-wise. Notice, by the way, in verse 5, the wording, it does not say, "Therefore, when he was born." Notice this is very clearly implying the pre-existence of Christ. Pre-existence of Christ simply means that he wasn't born at Bethlehem. That was not his beginning. And therefore, notice with the Bethlehem is only his appearance into the world. And in other words, when he comes into the world implies his pre-existence in verse 10. And again, notice he came, he was not born. Now, notice also in verse 5, you have something that makes Christ totally unique. We have in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." And we mentioned previously that that word "only begotten," monogenes, is a word that means unique. There's an example in Greek literature whereby they have discovered, so they think, a bird that they can't put in any category. They had never seen a bird like it. And they put the word monogenes on the bird. This is a bird like no other bird. We can't put it in a category of anything else. And in chapter 10, you're getting one of the features that makes him totally unlike any other. If you would think of the birth of any little child, and think of the child from birth on up to age 5, any child born in this world, and they have one single characteristic that is always there, an overpowering desire to submit their will to that of another. Characteristic? Boy, if there's anything that is not characteristic of a child, it is very quickly you learn, hey, that will doesn't want to submit to anybody or anything. Look at this child. When he comes into the world, he says, and this is unlike any other child ever born, sacrifice and offering thou hast not desired, but a body thou hast prepared me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come, in the roll of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God. So notice the uniqueness of the person of Christ coming into the world was his total submission to the will of God. No other child like it, or like him. Total submission to God, completely unlike any other child of the human race. Now, that is going to have some very, very strong, important things for us. But before we get to it, note one other thing. Notice you got a revelation in these verses about God's attitude in the Old Testament toward the sacrifices. How did he respond to the sacrifice? Well, notice coming down to chapter 10 and verse 5. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired. Now that ought to raise a question. Why wouldn't God desire the sacrifice when he's the one that commanded it? Why would he command them to make sacrifice and turn around and say, I don't want it? Continuing on down in the next verse, verse 6, and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have had no pleasure. So the question is, why would God not have pleasure in the sacrifices that he had commanded? And what is the reason? Very, very simply, the Old Testament sacrifices by themselves had no power. You know what gave the sacrifice power? Take it several places. Let me put this down. The Old Testament sacrifice by itself had absolutely no power. The Old Testament sacrifice alone had no power at all. None. In order for a sacrifice to be something that God took pleasure in, what had to go along with it? God repeated, and we'll see several passages like this, says, I cannot stomach a sacrifice that is not coupled with an obedience on the part of the one making it. Now let's see that. 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15. And the emphasis is, without obedience, the sacrifices had no power. Verse 22. And all I want you to see is the link that where there was not perfect obedience, there was no satisfaction with the sacrifice. Chapter 15 and verse 22. And Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? What's he saying? The only thing that gives a sacrifice validity is obedience. Continuing on. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen to the Lord than the fat of rams. For rebellion is the sin of divination, insubordination is an iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. So notice the emphasis. I don't care what kind of sacrifices you made, God does not take pleasure in them. Why? Because there is no obedience involved, and God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. Psalm 50. For the same idea. Psalm 50. Psalm 50 Psalm 50, verses 8 through 14. It says in verse 8, chapter 50, verse 8, I do not reprove you for your sacrifices, and your burnt offerings are continually before me. I shall take no young bull of your house, nor male goats out of your folds, for every beast in the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine, and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls, or drink the blood of male goats? Offer to the Lord a sacrifice of thanksgiving, and pay your vows to the Most High. So notice the emphasis. I'm not interested in any of your sacrifices where there is not obedience to me, such as paying your vows. Just across the page, Psalm 51, verse 16. David recognizes that without obedience, the sacrifice is of no value. Chapter 51 and verse 16. David observes that thou dost not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You are not pleased with burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O Lord, thou wilt not despise. Notice, no sacrifice alone had any power. It had to be coupled with obedience. Hosea 6. Hosea 6. And verse 6, Old Testament is shot through with the idea that without obedience, God cannot be pleased with any sacrifice. Now, does it make sense that the author of Hebrews, in talking about the sacrifice of Christ, would put in a little section to show how obedient he was? And that's what we've got in chapter 10. Chapter 6, verse 6. God says, I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. What is he saying? An offering without obedience is of no value whatsoever. Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah 7. The question will be this. When God brought Israel out of Egypt, what did he do first? Ask for obedience first or ask for sacrifices first? Chapter 7 and verse 22. Jeremiah speaks and says, I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them. Obey my voice, and I will be your God. And so what is Jeremiah arguing? You can make all of the sacrifices you want, but what did God ask for before he ever mentioned the word sacrifice to you? The thing that he asked for before any of this was obedience. Now let's take that back to Hebrews 10 and verse 7, and we ought to be able to see what he is saying. And we'll be looking here at the perfect obedience of Christ. And this will give us, by the way, a good definition of what perfect obedience is. Perfect obedience will have three features to it. Verse 7. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering thou hast not desired, but a body thou hast prepared me, and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hast taken no pleasure. Then I said, and the important thing about the word then is the word then is used in Greek as what is called a correlative adverb of time. And what it is saying is this, the obedience of Christ was immediate. The obedience of Christ was immediate. In other words, the very instant God's will was perceived, it was executed. And therefore, the idea is God's will was not put up for consideration, not in Christ's life. He never delayed. There was no time between perception of the Father's will and the execution of it, or there was never any delay. Delay in obedience implies disobedience. And so you've got in the little correlative adverb in verse 7, then I said, you've got the will of God matched by obedience on the part of the person of Christ. Second, his obedience was not only immediate, it was also complete. Immediate looks at when. Complete looks at how much. How obedient was he? Verse 7, then I said, behold. Now, if you wanted to make this, put a little delay into this, he would say, behold, I will come to do your will. But when you say, I will do it, you're applying, there's an implication of that it is not a complete obedience, and his obedience was complete. Last, and very important, is his obedience was scriptural. And that is found also in verse 7. Then I said, behold, I have come in the book of in the roll of the book, it is written of me to do thy will. And in other words, it was unquestioned, immediate obedience, and it is obedience to that which was in the Word of God. Now notice in verse 9, you then have a transition. You've got the perfectly obedient sacrifice, and now verse 10, you've got a transition. It says, then he said, behold, I have come to do thy will. He takes away the first, that's the old covenant, in order to establish the second. We move then from Old Testament to New Testament. Remember last week when we looked at verse 15, we said that the cross of Christ looks two ways. In the first place, the cross of Christ took all the way back to Adam, this is Hebrews 9:15, gathered up all of the sins of all of the forgiven saints in the Old Testament and placed it here on Christ. So you can look at the cross as from the standpoint of the cross was the execution of justice or of judgment on Old Testament sin. And we noted the fact that God in the Old Testament did some things that did not have an adequate basis. He forgave sin, for example. And the only adequate basis for forgiveness of sin is the cross, but he did it before the cross. So when the cross comes along, what's it do? It sort of shoots up a rocket and says, see, God is just and righteous after all. And when he called Abraham a his friend, even though he was a sinner, the basis for it was here. Now what else, coming down to verse 9, is the cross going to do? Looking backward, it gathers up all of the sin and takes care of it. Looking forward, it is the basis of a new covenant. And that's what you've got in verse 9. He takes away the first in order to establish the second. So what is the foundational thing on which the New Testament rests? The New Testament rests squarely on the cross work of Jesus Christ. Coming out of that, we have some new results. And they're in verse 10. And they are, number one, a new position, and number two, a permanent position. First of all, a new position. It says, by this will, that is the plan of God, we have been sanctified, perfect tense, means setting apart for his special possession, through the offering of the body of Christ once for all. The words once for all have got two connections here. They really connect with the whole verse. He is not just simply saying that Christ's offering was once for all. Grammatically, the once for all goes back up and connects also with the word sanctified. We have been set aside for him once for all, just like he made his offering once for all. And it connects to both, so that we have a once for all salvation on our part based on the once for all sacrifice made by him at the cross. And I'm sorry, it is at this point that I decided to vent my anger and destroy a disc, and with it the rest of my notes, which I was here to print out about 6:30 tonight, but There they are. So we'll close early. Continue in Hebrews chapter 10. We've mentioned in several lessons a very, very important point that to understand Hebrews definitely requires that we understand the function of the high priest. And we broke that down into some simple parts. The basic idea, of course, of a priest is the purpose is to bring man to God. It assumes that man and God are separated. That's the assumption that it rests on. And a priest is to solve that problem. And remember, in order to do so, there are three things he has to do. He has to remove the sin barrier. Sin, because of God's justice and righteousness, has created a barrier between ourselves and him. That has to be removed. Second, he has to not only remove the sin barrier, but he has to introduce man to God. And then the third thing which he has to do is to make that union permanent. And the thrust of our study in Hebrews has been very simply, none of the Old Testament priests could ever do it. On the positive side, the only one that can do that is the person of Christ who did all three of these things, removed the sin barrier, has introduced us to God, and he has made that union with him a perfect union. There are numerous doctrinal words in the New Testament that encircle all of this and tell us what he has done. And we want to, in the course of our study of Hebrews, talk about all of those words. When we talk about man getting introduced to God, the doctrinal word for that is the word reconciliation. And we want to do two things tonight. Number one, be sure we have down the five basic concepts that are involved in reconciliation, which is simply a doctrinal word, meaning that the high priest has introduced us to man, to God effectively. And we will look at the fact that, and do not take this down because we'll be doing them one in order, the fact that reconciliation, number one, presupposes a need. What is it? And number two, if you're going to reconcile, you've got to reconcile to something. Therefore, it preconceives a standard to which, and there has to be also a means of getting it done, and it has to affect a change on somebody, and then finally, reconciliation lays a responsibility on us. And so we'll use this as a basic doctrinal readout of the doctrine of reconciliation. And I think if we have these following points down, we ought to fairly well understand what does the Bible mean by reconciliation. So let's begin with the need. And in our notes, I'll simply be using R for reconciliation, so I won't have to write it every time. Go to a passage that is familiar with us, or to us, but probably so familiar that we haven't really read it correctly, and that is Romans 3:23. Really, if we understand biblical doctrine well, we ought to be able to do what we might call a readout of a doctrine. In other words, what does reconciliation mean? Can you simply read out for me the idea? And you would always start with the idea of need. Romans 3:23 is usually used by people to prove that men are sinners. That is really not the purpose of Romans 3:23. Romans 3:23 basically does the following things. It is given, first of all, to establish the universality of sin. The idea that the whole race is involved in it. And we get that when we have the 23rd verse, which is translated in our New American and King James, for all have sinned. And that could very easily take our minds to an act of sin that we have done within our lifetime. That is not it at all. The word have simply should not be there in translation. It is an aorist tense. All sinned is the idea. All sinned. Later on in Romans, he answers the question, when did we do it? And the when is in Romans 5:12. For as in Adam, all sinned. So this is not talking about taking cookies out of the cookie jar. This is not talking about stealing something. This is not talking about acts of sin that we have committed in our life. He simply says, back in Adam, something happened. Everybody in the human race sinned. You could almost say, all sinned once. Or all sinned fatally. It's looking backwards in time. It is not looking at acts of sin. The universality of sin. And what that does, of course, is that erects the problem of reconciliation. It's why we need it. This sin has erected a barrier between man and God. The second thing, after the universality of it, is the idea of the nature of it. Everyone did it. What is the nature of it? And the nature of it is described not in what we did, but in what we didn't do. Romans 3:23, we have all sinned, and here's how we did it. And fall short. And that is the present tense. And are falling short. The little Greek word there, hystereo, means to lack something you've got to have. I don't think our English quite gets that out. We all fall short. And the idea is to lack what is required. This is exactly the word that you would use if you were checking out of the grocery store and you had bought $3.53 worth of goods. And you begin to count out your money and you have $2.95. Hustereo, you just fell short. Tempted to put a little editorial in there. Just as a relaxing parenthesis for a minute. Do you ever get behind? I always get behind them. A lady with a purse this big. And she's going to buy an item, and it comes to $2.62. And so she gets out the big purse, opens the big purse, and what's inside the big purse? Another smaller purse. And so she gets out the smaller purse and lays out $2. But that's not the end of it, because on that smaller purse is what else? Another change purse hanging on the side. So she goes for the third layer, and she opens it up, and you ever seen anybody take it and dump it all out? No. She picks, just like a chicken going after one grain. She picks a quarter, and digs out and shakes around and gets another quarter. And then she begins to count out, and it comes up to 57 cents. So she scoops it all, puts it back in to the third purse, goes back to the second purse to get another dollar, and so forth. And do any of you do that? Do they do that? Betty does it. My gear shift is in the middle, and she always plops that big pig purse down. And you can't, you have to throw it on the floor. At any rate, the idea is something is clearly and definitely required, and we did not meet it. The thing required, of course, is the glory of God. Glory of God essentially is a reference to His total person. And if we want to know from the standpoint of the Word of God, what is a sinner? Real simply, a sinner is anybody less perfect than God. And this is, again, the background that gives us the need, or sets up the need, for reconciliation. So that, basically, it sets up a totally impossible situation. With reconciliation, you begin with man over here. And he is separated because of the fact that in Adam he sinned. And here is God, and we ought to label this diagram. This, as long as this exists, man is not unsaved. As long as this situation exists, he is unsavable. What do we mean? We simply mean, as long as this status exists, there is nothing in the world that God can do to save man. In other words, this situation has to be set aside. The doctrinal word for how this situation came from unsavable to savable is called reconciliation. And we'll find out how that was done and so forth, which is basically the work of the priest. But this is where we start with man in an impossible situation. You have some options that you could try. Since there is a need for reconciliation here, you could have man adjust to God. But since man is a sinner, you know that's not possible. Man can't move over here. That would be one solution. You could have a solution for God to move over here and overlook the sin, or God adjust a man. And what would both of those require? Both of those would require a change in character. If man adjusts to God, he's got to change his character, and he can't. If God is going to adjust a man, God would have to change his character, and God cannot change his character. So this basically is the need of reconciliation. All right, now, if we're going to reconcile, not only does it rest in a need, but you've got to reconcile to something, or second, pivotal thing in reconciliation, there must be a standard for the reconciliation. And let me give simply in the standard, there has to be consistency. Let's suppose that tonight when I left, I set my watch to the clock at the back of the auditorium. Came in the morning, compared the two, they didn't match, and this time I'll change the procedure and adjust the clock to my watch. Now who knows what time it is? No one does, because there was no fixed standard of reconciliation. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and I'll show you consistently to whom reconciliation is always made. Second Corinthians 5:18. And we'll find this many places. And what we'll find is that God himself is the standard. In reconciliation, God is the constant. Now that's how reconciliation to God, doctrinally, is different than reconciliation with two people. If you got two people who are at odds with one another, what is the standard of reconciliation going to be? It's going to be a mutual agreement, and both will have to change. If we said in reconciliation God has to change, what problems would he have? Well, number one, he's immutable. And number two, he's not the problem. And therefore, God himself is always the standard. He is the constant. So in reconciliation, think of this. Here is God. Man started out with fellowship with him and backed off, and now he's over here, and now there's a barrier between. Now, who's got to move? God cannot. This man over here must be picked up and moved over here. That is called reconciliation. And that is our third option. Number one, man adjusts to God, can't happen. God adjusts to man, can't happen. Third, God adjusts man to himself, doctrine of reconciliation. 2 Corinthians 5:18. And this is always true in reconciliation passages. God is always the constant. Now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ to give to us the ministry of reconciliation. Namely, that God was in Christ reconciling the world, what? To himself. God is always, always the standard in reconciliation. So, in reconciliation, God remains the same. And the problem of it is, how can God bring man to fellowship without changing? How can God bring man to fellowship without changing? He's got to remain the same. And that's solved by moving to a third facet of it, which is, what is God's means of reconciliation? The need, the standard, the means. Now let's simply go back to that same diagram that we had before. We'll set it up again with the need. God over here and man here. And as long as that exists, man is unsavable. Go to Ephesians 2:16. Always, always, God is the thing to whom we're reconciled. Verse 16, it says, and might reconcile them, he's talking about Jews and Gentiles, reconcile them both in one body, what are the next two words? To God. He is always the one to whom reconciliation is made. Now, what is the means? Through the cross. So, what is the means? The means is for God to take a step to make man savable. I didn't say saved. I said savable. And the means is the cross. So that by means of the cross, the barrier is removed. That doesn't save everybody, but it makes him savable. He can now be saved. And the means is always, always, always the cross. Without going to them, I'll give you a couple of other passages saying the same thing. Colossians 1:20, Romans 5:10 and 11. All right. Since that makes man savable, there is, fourth, a change that reconciliation makes, and it is dual. The first is man becomes savable. God can do it now. The means is there. The second part, it is where man becomes saved. And that is simply when he comes to faith appropriation. If we were going to diagram it for a third time, we'd put man over here, and I'll extend his hand a little ways. This is man. Everything on God's side is all set up. However, he is not saved. He's savable. He becomes saved when he does what? When he reaches over and takes hold right here and says, what was done at the cross in terms of reconciliation, I believe. The hardest thing for man to come to believe is very simple. God, because of the cross, doesn't have one single thing against anybody. God has nothing against anybody. The only sin that will cause men to perish will be the fact that they will not see it that way, and they will try to reform, and they will not see it that way, and they will try to approach God by works rather than saying, God has nothing against me. I know that because of the cross work of Jesus Christ. And it's just as simple as having a car on which you owe a certain amount of money, and you lay out the purchase price and you get a receipt. The dealer no longer has any claim on you because you paid the price. And if we look back at the reconciling work of Jesus Christ, he paid the price. God cannot collect anything more from me than he's already collected from his son, and it is on that we rest. Now, we ought to say, however, coming out of that change, there is finally, very clearly, a responsibility once we are reconciled. 2 Corinthians 5, once again. Now, let's read verse 20. First of all, from the standpoint of responsibility, it says, therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ. There is a responsibility. Representatives is what the word means. We're representatives for Christ as though God were entreating through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. Now, how are we going to explain this with verse 18? Is reconciliation finished, or is it unfinished? Reading verse 18 asks the question, is it finished? Now, all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ. That's a past work, isn't it? Well, how do you come down to verse 20, the last part, is we beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. Did he finish reconciliation, or did he not? Well, verse 18 is talking about this up here. Reconciliation complete. Encouraging people to be reconciled to God is this man reaching out and taking hold of it. In other words, reconciliation does not automatically save us. There is a part whereby we must come to faith in him to have that accomplished. And those basically are the concepts that are so important for reconciliation. And now with that, let's go to Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 19. Hebrews 10:18 ends the doctrinal argument of the book of Hebrews, which has been a comparison of the work of the high priest in the Old Testament with the present work of Jesus Christ. In short, up until this point, Hebrews says there's a difference between shadow and substance. or we use the illustration, you can have a specification sheet about all of the things that are going to be on the car. You can have a picture of the car so you can get a good idea of what the car looks like. However, you can't write a photograph. It will not get you from point A to point B. Old Testament has been loaded with photographs, good photographs, specifying without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sin. But no blood was shed, and therefore no real forgiveness. And that's been the argument up until this point. Now, assuming this is understood, that the symbol is gone and the reality is here, we can outline the rest of chapter 10 by saying he is going to now give us the practical consequences of all this. The practical results. And it breaks into four basic thoughts. Number one, since we have been saved by him and his sacrifice is complete for us, number one, he says, I want to focus on your privileges. And privileges is the theme of 19 through 22. And let's read the verses to get that thrust. We won't get through all four of these tonight, but I wanted to see how the passage looked. Verse 19, notice the emphasis on privilege. Now, since therefore, brethren, see the since therefore, we're now coming to practical conclusions about the fact that Christ is the perfect sacrifice. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence. Notice we're getting a psychological impact of what he has done for us. We have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus. Notice the emphasis on our privilege. By a new and living way, which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is his flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near. That's a privilege. Let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. So 19 through 22 is all privilege. However, not only is there privilege, there is duty. And the duty of the believer is spelled out in 23 through 25. And if you can easily read and see the duty. Verse 23, let us hold fast. That's a command. That's a duty. Verse 24, let us consider how to stimulate to love one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. And so that is going to focus on duty. However, when you come down to verse 26, there is something that we can call our peril. 26 through 31. And this is fraught with the idea that there is peril involved in the light of the sacrifice of Christ. Verse 26, if we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but a certain terrifying expectation. And you begin to see that there's something very electrifying and very powerful in these verses, and we'll see it when we get down to that point. Then finally, in 32 through the end of the chapter, is a section about our encouragement. 32 through 39. Again, that's easy to see. Verse 35, therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. Verse 36, if you have need of endurance, so that we have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised, and so forth. And the emphasis is on being encouraged as believers. Now, tonight, I think we'll have time for maybe the first two, at least the first one. So now is our privilege under the new covenant. And basically, I'm going to put our privilege singular, because it is singular in this passage, our privilege under the new covenant, verses 19 through 22. And notice we have the first benefit that comes from his sacrifice. And it is spelled in great big letters, C C-O-N-F-I-D-E-N-C-E, confidence. God wants confident believers. Everything else in these verses down through verse 21 is going to support the idea of confidence. Confidence is a major idea. Verse 19. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence. Now that's real interesting because that's simply saying I have taken you through 10.5 chapters of doctrinal teaching. And the thing you ought to come out with first and foremost in terms of personal practical results is you ought to now be a believer who is confident. In other words, he should have shattered any lack of assurance and brought us all the way up to the point where we can say the outstanding characteristic of this believer is his confidence. Now, everything in the rest of this verse is going to support these ideas. Now, this, suppose you are an Old Testament saint, and he has said, the very thing I'm bringing to you is assurance and confidence. Let's make a couple of comparisons. First of all, compare this with, this boldness now, with the Old Testament high priest. And what do we know about him? How confident was he in approaching God? Number one, in terms of confidence, he was limited as to time. Once a year. He was limited as to extent, only the high priest. And he was limited as to, how shall we put it? Limited as to, well, he had to put the smoke around the ark. Limited as to directness. And you remember what happened. And again, this would shock any. If you were an Old Testament believer, how much confidence could you have about the presence of God? We studied enough about the tabernacle to know that. How confidently would you march in through the first veil, pass up the altar, pull open the curtain to the second veil, and walk in and, so to speak, before the ark, say, "Hello, Lord." How confident would you be in doing that? A couple of men, as they were transporting the ark, it started to tumble, and they did the natural thing. They grabbed it. What happened to them? Struck dead. And in the light of the fact that even if you were a high priest, on the right day at the right time, how confidently would you approach the ark? Remember what you had to do? You had to have this Leviticus 16:12. It says when he went on that one day, he had to take some altar fire, and he had to be sure it was real smoky. And when he got in under that inner place, he had to be sure that that smoke enshrouded the ark, quote, lest he die. Now, I don't know about you, but even if I were high priest on the right day, and if I were the right person, I would go in there scared to death. Scared that maybe when I opened the veil that it might create a draft. And the draft might blow the smoke off to the east and it would miss the altar and I would see it and zap. Frankly, even the high priest would have to approach the presence of God with absolute terror, much less any other person that a common Israelite who at the wrong time of the year, not being a high priest, would walk in there. That's absolutely sure death. So you would face the presence of God with sheer terror in the Old Testament in terms of the tabernacle. And therefore, you come down to chapter 10, and what is the first thing he says about the sacrifice of Christ? He says, therefore, brethren, we are confident. And confident is a word for being downright bold and forward in our approach to God. So comparing it back with the Old Testament priest, this is a new concept. Now, compare it with another thing. Compare this boldness with our own condition. And our condition, you well know, we are sinners. How is it possible for a... Do you think... How could this boldness in verse 19 be delivered from arrogance? Does it strike you as arrogant for someone to say, I know without any question that if I die this moment, I go immediately to the presence of the Lord. Now, how is that different from arrogance? How are we going to distinguish it from being pridefully arrogant? Well, if you look at 10:19, we've got it right in front of us. Seeing, therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place. And what is it that excludes it from arrogance? The next four or five words. It is by the blood of Jesus. So what's he simply saying? If we are bold in coming into the presence of God because we are good, that is sheer arrogance. However, we don't come in on that basis. We come in on the basis of merits that are not our own, and it is therefore not arrogance, but simple. Put it this way. If salvation is by grace, meaning it's all on his merits, then boldness is simply pure faith. If it's on the basis of grace, we come to God then on the basis of simple faith. If, however, we approach God on the basis of works, then boldness is simple arrogance. So we can be bold for different reasons. We can have a boldness that is plain sinful. And I have to admit, if man thinks that he can walk into the presence of God because he is so good, that's arrogance. But grace simply says, I'm not coming on the basis of my merits. I'm coming on the basis of simple faith. And if you've talked to many unbelievers who are strangers to God's grace, and you would look them in the eye and say, if I die now, I go immediately to be with the Lord. They're probably going to look at you and say what? Well, who in the world do you think you are? Because what's their mentality? Their mentality is if you say you go into the presence of God, that you deserve it. And they have never touched grace mentality, which says we go to the presence of God not because we deserve it, but on the merits of one another. And therefore, the extent that we have confidence is going to be to the extent that we understand God's grace. If we are legalists, we cannot have confidence. A legalist is always worried. A legalist never knows whether he's done enough. I don't care whether that's in salvation or the Christian life. He is afraid in terms of salvation that I haven't done enough and therefore I might not make it. And if he's a Christian who is a legalist, he is never bold and confident either. He's always scared because he's afraid he might have done the wrong thing that destroyed the favor of God and the throne of grace. The door is now shut and I can't come into his presence. And again, is pure non-grace mentality. All right? Now, one other thing. Let's compare third. Compare it with the Old Testament high priest. We can come, all believers at all times now. We compare it with our own condition. It is not arrogance because it rests on his work. And now let's make a third comparison. Is compare our approach with the Old Testament veil. Now, that Old Testament veil, I think we need to understand it from three standpoints. First of all, in the Old Testament, you had its physical presence. Second, you had, with the death of Christ, its physical destruction. Now, if we go that far in our understanding of the veil, we would simply say, when God destroyed that veil, there was no veil left. Right? Wrong. Absolutely wrong. Let's see why. First of all, the physical presence of the veil in the Old Testament did what? It was basically God's no trespassing sign. It simply said, I'm over here, here's the curtain, and here's man, and this sign says, don't you come over or you'll die. And it simply said, no trespassing. With the death of Christ, remember that got torn in two from top to bottom. And when it was torn in two from top to bottom, what was the message conveyed? First of all, think of two messages that veil could convey. One true one and one false one. The true one would be simply this. With the torn veil, the approach to God is open and you have free access to God. Anybody can come. But now think of an erroneous message there. The veil is torn in two. Everyone can come. And doesn't it not imply that perhaps you can come, anyone got it yet? Any way you choose? So we come down to Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 20. And we notice that when the veil was torn in two, that didn't mean you can come to God any way you want, because there is a third aspect of the veil, or let's put this, the new one erected. So we can really say there isn't any veil, but there is. There isn't any veil because the way to God is open for everyone, but there is a veil in the sense that there's only one way you can get to God, and notice that's in verse 20. We have a new and living way which He inaugurated for us through the veil that is His flesh. Is there a veil or is there not? Yes, there is. But the veil is now what? The veil is now the person of Christ. And the person of Christ is saying, you can come to God, but you can only come one way. And so it's sort of the idea of God puts up a curtain and says, if you learn the lesson, you got to keep out. Now we come to the cross. And He tears the veil in two, and He says, now with the veil cut in two, have you found out that the way to open to God is now open? And then comes along with the book of Hebrews and teaches that Christ is the veil. Now we have taught the lesson that the only way to God for anyone is through Him. So the veil opens up, and then we turn around and the veil shuts off the presence of God to only those that will come through the person of Christ. And this is what we've got now down in chapter 10, verse 20, is that Christ Himself is now the veil. All right? Therefore, we have the benefit of His perfect sacrifice. Now, notice down in verse 21, we have a second benefit. And that is the benefit of His perfect priesthood. If the benefit of His perfect sacrifice was confidence, what is the benefit of His perfect priesthood? C-O-N-F-I-D-E-N-C-E. Confidence. Verse 21. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with sincere heart in what? Full assurance of faith. What's he saying? Look at Christ's work two places, at the cross and where he is right now at the Father's right hand, and they both have the same message. This is what he did for us. This is what he does for us, or is doing for us. And the same lesson comes out of both. He made a perfect sacrifice, and therefore I am bold to come to God. And I can look back, and I get confidence. But I can also look up, and I recognize that he's seated at the Father's right hand as my personal high priest, and therefore I am still confident. So in the Christian experience, any way we look, we have absolute confidence. That is possible. It comes out of His sacrifice. It comes out of His work. All right, now down to verse 21, or verse 20, yes, 21. Since we have a great priest. Now, what is it that makes the adjective great qualify to be put on the front of the word priest? Why great? These words are important. It's so easy in English, especially, I think, because of advertising, that we put so many superlative adjectives on things. You know, how are you? Fantastic. And I love the English language. And for that reason, that sends chills over me, because the word fantastic is a very strong word. You're not fantastic. We had a fabulous time. That's not the right word. You don't ever have a fabulous time. That's too much word for that, and pretty soon when you use strong words, super colossal. I have never seen anything in my life that is super colossal, never. Colossal, maybe. Super colossal, that's just too heavy. And what happens, we begin to use strong adjectives, and when you use strong adjectives in everyday conversation, what happens to them? They become meaningless. So that you come to the New Testament, and the author is very careful to say he's our priest. And when he really wants to give some zip to it, he puts great on the front of it. And we ought to refresh ourselves that this is not just the common greeting. How are you today? Oh, I'm great. It's either got to be egotistical or we've really misused the word, you know. Tell someone, how are you today? I'm great. Good. Okay. Now, what is it that makes him qualify? Wherein does the greatness lie? And basically, that word great has three colossal, super colossal things behind it. They're fantastic. They're great. They're out of sight. Out of sight, I've never understood, but at any rate. First of all, his greatness lies in what we've had so far, his person, chapter 1, his position, had this several times, we could use 8:1. Now the main point of what has been said is this, we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens. Makes him great, his position. And finally, his sacrifice. And we could use 10:10 for that. And doesn't it seem to think of the sublimity of his person, the enormity of his position, the greatness of his sacrifice, to have all of that carried on one little word, great, high priest. And that is what is behind all of that. Now, notice, in approaching him, there are two things. We have to have a subjective condition, and second, we have to have an objective one. In approaching him, what is the subjective condition that we must meet? All right, that's found in verse 22. Let us draw near with a sincere heart. And that is the first subjective condition that is necessary. The sincere heart. Sincere heart, in translation, doesn't really quite get it. If you know any Greek, you recognize the word alethanos. And alethanos means in accord with truth. It means for anything that harmonizes with truth. So he's saying we must have a heart that is in accordance with truth. Or, what would that be? A heart that operates on doctrine, on true doctrine. In approaching God, what true doctrine do we have to know? We have to know that he will only save those that come to God through him. We have to understand the doctrine of mediatorship. You can't get to God apart from Christ. We have to understand the doctrine that he is deity. We have to understand the doctrine of redemption, that he has made us adequate sacrifice for sin. We need to understand the doctrine that we got to approach through him because we are sinners and God is just and righteous and cannot accept us apart from his son. And therefore, how do we approach God? With a heart loaded with doctrine. A heart loaded with truth. And that's what's involved in the sincere. Sincere conveys in English, doesn't it? Means business. You're not false. And granted, that's true, but that doesn't get the word alethanos, which means something that is in accord with truth. Second, we come with a heart of full assurance of faith. And the idea of the full assurance of help simply means we have no qualms about approaching God on a faith basis only. Don't have any problems with that. We recognize and are confident that it's faith and faith alone. In other words, the full assurance, a test of faith means we don't have any doubts but what the faith approach is the right one. Our faith is really assured. This is the way to go, is the idea. So it's saying we have a faith that says there's no other way. And I'm happy not to bring any other things to put on the altar. Faith is the only way I approach God. That is a subjective condition. There also must be an objective one. And the objective one puts it basically in Old Testament terms, but I think we can understand it. In verse 22, let us draw near with a sincere heart, that's inner. Full assurance of faith, that's inner. Now notice here, having our hearts sprinkled clean from all evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Emphasis here on the idea that we come cleansed. And again, it's putting it in Old Testament terms. They came before God on the basis of water sprinkled on something external. We come having experienced regeneration in the heart, and it's simply expressing the idea that we have had an interchange by His reconciling work, and it's explaining it in Old Testament terms. All right, from that, we now turn, and we have time just to get into it, to our duties under the Old Covenant, a New Covenant. Our duties under the New Covenant, verses 23 through 25. And basically, it breaks down two ways. Number one, duty to doctrine. And number two, duty to one another. First of all, duty to doctrine, 10:23. Says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope. The word confession inevitably is used for what you believe. The truth you believe, our confession, is our body of beliefs. And He's been giving us a body of beliefs in Hebrews. What would He mean? Let's hold fast our body of beliefs or our confessions. Well, we believe the sacrifice of Jesus Christ is final and complete. Hang on to it. We believe from chapter 1 that He is deity. Hang on to that. We believe that He is seated at the Father's right hand. Hang on to that. You say, well, I wouldn't give those things up. Well, it is not laying hold of them when we, for example, look at ourselves and say, I really wonder, I'm really wavering over my assurance of salvation. You know what that's doing? That's not holding on to your beliefs. That is not holding on to the confession that says He made a once-for-all adequate sacrifice. And so this is very, very relevant. Take the doctrine we know and hang in there with it and stick with it in the fullest sense of the word. Now notice there is a particular focus, however. It's especially the part of things that we believe that are present or that are future. Well, let us hold fast the confession of our hope. So the emphasis is on especially the part of our doctrine about the future. Especially that. Especially the future part. Hold on to what you believe, especially the future part. What, for example, is the future part of what we believe? Well, we believe, for example, that our redemption will be completed when we are body, soul, and spirit with Him. Why do you think He is pointing these believers to the future part of our salvation, our hope? Because holding on to the future part of salvation is the only remedy for discouragement. And these believers were discouraged. Go over to chapter 10, verse 32. The remedy for chapter 2 is always the final chapter of the book. And in chapter 2 of their existence as believers, they were having some rough times. And what they needed to do was to look at the final chapter, or their hope. Beginning in verse 32, remember the former days when after being enlightened you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners, accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. So that's the condition they were in. Their property was being confiscated. Some of them were suffering real persecution, being made a spectacle for Christ. And therefore, when He says in verse 23, hold fast to doctrine, especially the part that makes up your hope. And He's simply saying, what is the hope for the present suffering in the Christian experience, the future? And that is the part that He emphasizes there. Second, they had a duty to one another in the body of Christ. And that duty we'll describe as individual, and number two, corporate. First of all, individual in verse 24. And let us consider Now, I don't know how to express that the word consider is a strong, strong, strong word. The word for think is not at all. And on the front of that word, they put a preposition to give it strength. Kata na eo. And the idea involved is intense thought. And basically, the word observe is used for careful observation, so as to gain correct perception. Careful observation so as to gain correct perception. And we could take that word, if we were going to tonight, trace it throughout the New Testament and show that always it is don't arrive at an opinion, don't get a perception until you've thought. And so this is saying, in regard to one another, we regard one another very thoughtfully with reference how we can, the Greek old King James has used the word provoke one another. Usually provoke, this word, is used in a bad sense. However, we do not need practice and careful thought to know how to do that. We do that naturally. We need careful thought to know how to stimulate one another to love and to good deeds. Now, the question immediately comes up, how can we stimulate one another to love? I know we can all get bumper stickers and say, honk if you love Jesus. That will stimulate. Well, we're not left at the end of verse 24 to say, how do we do it? There is a how we do it that is explained in verse 25 by two participles. And in verse 25, we'll have how we can stimulate one another corporately within the assembly. Two how-to participles, one of them negative. And really, I would prefer very much to translate this way, reading verse 24. Let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and to good deeds by not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. So how could they do it? They could do it by regular assembly worship. Very frankly, looking at it from my perspective, you stimulate me to study, to teach. And how do you do it? You do it by being here. You can't go by expressions, but you do it sometimes by expression on face. I study all week. And you can't help when you've looked at faces on Sunday. You'll see someone that is getting hold of something, and you come in Monday morning, and as you're studying, you study with faces in mind, and you see someone sitting there, boy, they're coming along, they're seemingly making progress, and that stimulates into study, and it's a stimulation by the local assembly. And who knows, without words and without an attempt, how your interest in assembly worship may be affecting somebody else. And this is... can you think, by the way, of why do you think these believers might forsake assembly worship? They were doing it. In fact, it's very clear in verse 20, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some. Why would you think that they were perhaps doing that? I can think of three reasons. Number one, persecution because of association. Go over to chapter 10. Again, verse 34. It says, you showed sympathy to the prisoners and perhaps as a result accepted joyfully the seizure of your property. So very simply, it was dangerous to associate with believers. I can think of a couple of other reasons too. These Jewish believers had been used to worship in the temple and in the synagogue. And you know what? The temple and the synagogue was beautiful. Where do they meet for assembly worship? Well, mostly poor people meet in someone's house. It didn't have the aesthetics of the synagogue. And therefore, you can think of those very, very practical reasons. Or do you think they were different than today? It was saying, I just can't get away from the beautiful... They had that problem, but I can't get away from the beauty of the temple, the magnificence of it, the glory of it. and then have to go over here and meet with a bunch of grubbies that are getting persecuted. I don't like that. And therefore, some of them were forsaking assembly worship. The second participle is positive. Not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. Encouraging one another to do what? Well, I think we got to take it by context, don't we? Encourage one another to participate in assembly worship. This is not just going over and say, hey, everything will be okay. This is encouraging one another to participate in assembly worship, and all the more for you all at Beth Haven in the 20th century, since the day is growing much nearer than it was when the book of Hebrews was written. And therefore, you have a very, very important section on the duty of believers, and basically here, it is to hold on to doctrine, and the means of doing it is by the gathered assembly of believers in the local church, whereby doctrine is taught and exalted, the Lord is taught and exalted, and we ought to encourage one another in terms of that. All right, we'll be ready to pick up next time then with the peril that we face in verses 26 through 31. Father, tonight we thank you again for your work, your perfect reconciliation. We're thankful that we can come to you boldly, not because of what we are in any sense of the word, but we come through the blood of Jesus Christ on his merits and his merits alone. We give you thanks that we can approach you.